American Majority.
Days of Revolution is a podcast brought to you by AmericanMajority.org. This is Ned Ryan, and welcome to Episode 1, The Die is Cast. On the morning of July 2, 1776, the delegates of the Second Continental Congress formally voted to separate the American colonies from Great Britain. Whereas the room had been filled in the days leading up to the second with loud and sometimes bitter debate, today the room was hushed, like the quiet before the storm, with each man fully aware of the magnitude of what they were doing. Several hundred years removed, it's hard to fully grasp what this handful of men had been doing in the confines of the State House in Philadelphia that summer of 1776, day after day, night after night. Their debates leading up to the 2nd of July were not simply an exercise in rhetoric or an examination of esoteric principles of freedom and liberty. Their debates centered around this: would they or would they not officially take up arms against their mother country and with musket and sword win their independence? Armed conflict had finally burst into the open over a year before with Lexington and Concord, but even now there were some among those gathered at the Second Continental Congress who argued for peaceful reconciliation with Great Britain. The men gathered in Philadelphia were not just any men. These were the leading citizens of the colonies, who a short time before had all been loyal British citizens. Some of them, like James Wilson, were newly arrived in America, while most were only a generation or two removed from England. Yet here they were in Philadelphia discussing what was described by the Crown as nothing less than armed rebellion. They, in fact, if they declared independence, would be declared traitors to the crown. It wasn't as though relations had devolved quickly between the American colonies and England. Over the course of the previous 13 years, since the signing of the peace treaty ending the French and Indian War, tensions between the colonies and the mother country had little by little grown until a succession of events brought the colonists into open and armed conflict with Great Britain. The ill will between colonists and England had, of course, been accelerated by events like the Boston Massacre in 1770 and the Coercive Acts of 1774, which were meant to crush Massachusetts and which were viewed by many of the colonists as a violation of the British Constitution and as a threat to their liberties. In September of 1774, the leading men of the colonies met in Philadelphia, forming the First Continental Congress to discuss what was to be done with their relations with England. The Congress organized a boycott of British goods and petitioned King George III to repeal the Coercive Acts. King George refused and wrote his Prime Minister, Lord North, that blows must decide whether they, the colonies, are to be subject to this country or independent. Through the spring of 1775, tensions worsened between the colonies and Great Britain until in April of 1775, British troops had been sent into the Massachusetts countryside to seize arms, gunpowder, and rebel leaders like John Hancock and Sam Adams, only to be met by the musket fire of the Minutemen and to be driven back into Boston, where for months George Washington and the ragtag militia and Continental Army successfully laid siege to the British in Boston. The British had attempted to break the siege at Bunker Hill, but the massive losses suffered by the British in the end accomplished nothing, and the siege of Boston would continue on until the spring of 1776. In late 1775, King George III issued a proclamation of rebellion and announced to Parliament that he was considering friendly offers of assistance to suppress the colonies. The colonists had hoped that the king would intercede with them before Parliament, but King George was determined to bring the colonies to heel, either by draconian measures meant to crush the economic life out of the colonies or by armed force if necessary. In February of 1776, Parliament passed the Prohibitory Act, which established a blockade of American ports and declared all American ships to be enemy vessels. And then if relations could have become any worse between England and the colonies, it was learned that King George had hired Hessian mercenaries to use against the colonists, who were at this time still British subjects. In March of 1776, George Washington and the Continental Army scored a much-needed victory, forcing the British out of Boston. Washington and the colonists succeeded by placing large artillery pieces, captured by Ethan Allen and Henry Knox the fall before at Fort Ticonderoga, on Dorchester Heights overlooking Boston. Of course, the victory at Boston for the colonists was only an opening salvo on a war that would last for over 6 years. And by the summer of 1776, George Washington and the Continental Army were facing off in New York City with General Howe and the British Army of over 20,000 men. On April 12, 1776, the North Carolina Provincial Legislature sent its congressional delegation the Halifax Resolves, which explicitly authorized the delegates to vote for independence. And on May 4th, the Rhode Island legislature declared its independence from Great Britain. Just over 10 days later, the Virginia Assembly instructed its delegates in Congress, including Thomas Jefferson and Richard Henry Lee, to propose to Congress that the Congress declare the colonies independent of Great Britain. On May 15th, after several days of debate, a preamble drafted by John Adams for Congress, which stated that because King George III had rejected any attempts at reconciliation and was in fact hiring foreign mercenaries to use against his subjects, it is necessary that the exercise of every kind of authority under the said crown should be totally suppressed. Adams called for an overthrow of the governments of Pennsylvania and Maryland, which were still under royal governance. The four middle colonies voted against the preamble, but the measure passed, and Congress instructed the colonies to establish their own legislatures, independent of any royal charter. Then, on June 7, 1776, Lee of Virginia proposed to Congress that these united colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. Lee also proposed that measures be taken to immediately procure the assistance of foreign powers and a confederation be formed to bind the colonies more closely together. And then began a contentious debate which lasted for weeks. John Dickinson and James Wilson would argue that such measures should not be taken and that perhaps peaceful reconciliation with Great Britain was still attainable. And the delegates from Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland, and New York were not yet authorized to vote for independence, and some even threatened to leave Congress should a vote be forced on the issue. But John Adams, Richard Henry Lee, and others led the charge for independence, claiming that they should seek a formal declaration to acknowledge a fact that was already in existence. The colonies were no longer part of the British Empire, as was evidenced by Parliament and King George's actions. King George had declared the colonies outside of his protection, and the colonies were now viewed as enemy combatants. And if they were to receive any foreign aid, they must make the separation from Great Britain formal. Realizing that there were five states unwilling or unable to move on a vote for independence, the Congress formed a committee to draft a declaration on June 11th. Thomas Jefferson of Virginia, John Adams of Massachusetts, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and Robert Livingston of New York were appointed to write a formal statement of independence, with Jefferson writing the first draft of the document. John Adams would write in his autobiography about the writing of the declaration that the committee had several meetings in which were proposed the articles of which the declaration was to consist and minutes made of them. The committee then appointed Mr. Jefferson and me to draw them up in form and clothe them in a proper dress. The subcommittee met and considered the minutes, making such observations on them as then occurred. When Mr. Jefferson desired me to take them to my lodgings and make the draft, this I declined and gave several reasons for declining. One, that he was a Virginian and I a Massachusettsian. Two, that he was a Southern man and I a Northern one. Three, that I had been so obnoxious from my early and constant zeal in promoting the measure that any draft of mine would undergo a more severe scrutiny and criticism in Congress than one of his composition. Fourth, and lastly, and that would be reason enough if there were no other, I had a great opinion of the elegance of his pen, and none at all of my own. I therefore insisted that no hesitation should be made on his part. He accordingly took the minutes, and in a day or two, produced to me his draft. I want to highlight something else of interest here. While Benjamin Franklin helped draft the Declaration of Independence, the Provincial Congress of New Jersey resolved that the royal governor of the state, Franklin's son, William, was in fact an enemy of the liberties of the country, and they had him arrested. I think this makes a point of something that many times people forget. The American Revolution was in some ways America's first civil war. It should be remembered about the American Revolution that 30% of the colonists were Tories, loyalists to the crown, who saw no reason to declare independence and would in fact take up arms on behalf of the crown. The American Revolution would pit brother against brother, father against sons, sons against mothers, and neighbors against neighbors. Some of the most brutal fighting during the war would not take place between the British and the colonists, but between the Tory loyalists and the colonists, those who wished to remain British subjects, and the colonists calling for independence. On Friday, June 28th, just over 2 weeks after Jefferson and the committee had been assigned the task of drafting the Declaration of Independence, the final draft of the document was brought to the floor of the House. It was read and then ordered to lie on the table. That next Monday, the Congress took up once again the issue of independence, and New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, and Georgia voted for independence. South Carolina and Pennsylvania voted against it, and Delaware was a split vote, with its two-man delegation canceling each other out. The New York delegation expressed their support for the declaration, but insisted that their hands were tied by the instructions from their state legislature to work towards reconciliation. After the vote, Edward Rutledge of South Carolina, who's actually opposed to Lee's resolution calling for independence, but realizing there must be unanimity on the issue of independence, asked that the vote on final determination for independence be held the next day. That night, several things happened. Caesar Rodney of Delaware, the third delegate from the state, who was away serving as Brigadier General of Delaware's militia, received word from Thomas McKean that McKean and George Reed were deadlocked on the vote for independence. To break that deadlock, Rodney, suffering from facial cancer and serious asthma, rode 80 miles through the summer heat in a severe thunderstorm that night of July 1, 1776, dramatically arriving in Philadelphia in his boots and spurs on July 2nd, just as the voting was beginning. Rodney was reported to have at once entered the state house and say, "As I believe the voice of my constituents and of all sensible and honest men is in favor of independence, my own judgment concurs with them. I vote for independence." Meanwhile, John Dickinson, one of the leaders of the Pennsylvania delegation, who was opposed to independence, realized that the tides were shifting from reconciliation to independence. And so that morning of July 2nd, Dickinson and Robert Morris, also of Pennsylvania, deliberately did not show up at the state house, allowing the Pennsylvania delegation to vote for independence. That morning of July 2nd, the vote for independence was taken, and 12 of the states, excluding New York, voted for independence from England. New York abstained because its delegation had not yet received the authority from its state assembly to vote for independence. The men knew what they were doing. It was not just a vote for independence. It was an act that would irrevocably send the colonies into armed conflict, with the colonies either winning their freedom or England brutally bringing them back into the empire. There was no other course. There would be no more talk, no more hopes of reconciliation, only war. And that is something to highlight. There were no guarantees that morning of July 2nd, 1776, that their cause would actually succeed. They were up against one of the great European superpowers, who was at the height of its military power. In return, all they had was a somewhat ragtag army of untrained militia that was desperately short on equipment at virtually every point in the conflict. And yet they signed the document because they believed that any sacrifices would pale in light of the gains made for freedom and liberty. John Adams would write Abigail on July 3rd, but the days passed. The second day of July 1776 will be the most memorable in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore. You will think me transported with enthusiasm, but I am not. I am well aware of the toil and blood and treasure that it will cost us to maintain this declaration and support and defend these states. Yet through all the gloom, I can see the rays of ravishing light and glory. I can see that the end is more than worth all the means, and that posterity will triumph in that day's transaction, even although we should rue it, which I trust in God we shall not. On July 4th, a cool but bright and sunny day in Philadelphia, Congress would officially adopt the Declaration. John Hancock, the president of the Congress, and Charles Thompson, the Congress's secretary, did not sign the document, but would have their names affixed to the document and have it sent over to a local printer by the name of John Dunlap. That night, Dunlap would print 200 broadsides of the Declaration, of which 24 still exist today. You'll actually know a Dunlap broadside by the fact that it only has Hancock and Thompson's printed names on them. On July 8th, the Declaration was officially read in public in Philadelphia, and the next day Washington ordered that it be read to the Continental Army, which was in New York at the time. Though there is some controversy as to when the rest of the delegates actually signed the document, whether July 4th or August 2nd, I will tend towards the August 2nd date, if only for the reason that the Dunlap broadsides printed the night of July 4th have only two names. So on August 2nd, according to some historians, 34 men were present in Philadelphia to sign the Declaration, with the other 22 signers signing the document over the next several months. The document was signed in order of the colonies from north to south, with New Hampshire being the first to sign and Georgia the last, with each delegation stepping forward and each man affixing his signature to the document. Those leaning over to sign the document surely glanced at the last words, "We pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." No doubt many of them believed that they would be sacrificing their lives and fortunes to fight for freedom, but they signed nonetheless. John Hancock, as president of the Congress, was the first to sign the document. According to legend, Hancock wrote his signature in such large letters so that George III could read it without his glasses, though there is little historical reason to believe Hancock did it for that reason. Some signing occasionally broke the silence. Benjamin Harrison of Virginia, a strapping man, commented after Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, a tiny, frail, bird-like man, signed the document, that, "I shall have a distinct advantage over you, Mr. Gerry, when we are all hung for what we are now doing. From the size and weight of my body, I shall die in a few minutes. But from the lightness of your body, you shall dance in the air an hour or two before you are dead." This podcast series is going to be an examination of what led these men to declare independence and risk their lives, to take up arms and to fight to be free. It was a process of years that had led them to take the measures of independence. But even then, the real seeds of freedom and liberty had been sown almost from the very founding of the colonies over 150 years prior to July 2nd, 1776. Join me next time as I discuss the founding of the first American colonies as the eastern seaboard of North America begins to be settled by Europeans, coming to the New World for anything from religious freedom to a search for riches and wealth. Days of Revolution is a podcast series brought to you by AmericanMajority.org. And as a podcast written by Ned Ryan and Eric Josephson, and recorded by Ned Ryan. If you enjoy this podcast on American history, be sure to check out The History of the Constitutional Convention by Ned Ryan at AmericanMajority.org or on iTunes.